Welcome to Belt to Loda, the officially unofficial podcast for The Expanse on Amazon Prime. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 6, Episode 5, Why We Fight. It's the penultimate episode, not just for the season, but for the show. And they had a lot of ground to cover. I feel like they were moving things, like knowing kind of roughly where this is going. I felt like they moved pieces appropriately close to the finish line, so I'm excited by that. And I thought this was just an excellent episode all around. How'd you feel about it?
And not being a book reader, I remember my son and I watched this last night together for the first time, and we're both like, my God, how are they going to wrap this up in like an hour and 6 minutes of television? Because it is going to be a supersized episode, this next one. It's like an hour and 10 runtime. The average one has been, I think, between 43 and 48 this year. Because, you know, in my mind, the things that they, the strange dog shit, whatever. But the things they have to answer is, what's the deal with the new protomolecule ships? What is the fate of Marco and his free navy? And like, how are they going to like, and also the mystery of the ring gate, like what is going on with the red fire that's dissolving ships? Like, to me, those are the three things that have to be resolved. And I just don't see how you divide like an hour and 6 minutes up and get satisfying and also have enough time to give like an emotional, I imagine it'll be like a 10 minute epilogue. That's going to kind of at least 10, 15 minute epilogue that kind of like, puts to bed the major characters that we care about and give them fitting in,
but not totally
tributes if any of them fall. What?
No, not totally. We don't want to totally put them to bed, right? Because who knows what happens in the future?
There's got to be an opening for further adventures and things like that. This was an interesting episode that, like, you know, when the Martians went through the ring gate and got their shit kicked in, I'm like, God damn, those protomolecule ships. Turns out those aren't even the proto. That's like some ring, something that we had no idea what was going on.
Those are what you're calling the protomolecule ships. So those railguns were what was coming through.
Really?
Yeah, they were just being transported.
So those aren't spaceships?
Those were not spaceships, no. No, they were very pointy. And if you look at like Avasarala's schematics of those things or readouts, whatever, they look, if you flip them, they look pretty much just like what we saw coming through the gate.
Boy, I guess I would have appreciated a little bit more of like things being tugged or, you know, like it's okay. That's all right. Fair enough. So there's no protomolecule ship. So there's one less thing that has to be resolved.
Well, there is one. There's
hour
some
and six? No
construction
problem.
Platform around Laconia, which I guess is a protomolecule ship of some type, but.
Yeah. Or maybe it's a shipyard, you know, because they talked about the, you know, Marco. I mean, that was an interesting thing that I thought from the episode too, that scene with him and Renfield, where she's like, look, it doesn't matter what happens in the system. You control the ring gate now and you have access to it's just inevitable that you've got access to 1300 systems, count like all the material you'd need, all the like, I thought it's like, God, I don't know how you defeat this. But I thought it was excellent because like, I thought all of the emotional stakes were correct. And, you know, I thought, for the first time, I thought, like, boy, what is people's that are not watching the X-rays experience with this season? Because, like, this episode, I felt like built a lot on one or two of those things where it's like, you probably picked it up, but like, Avasarala injecting herself with stuff, like, what the hell? And then
the drummer,
you know,
episode, I thought was
the drummer,
like,
right,
lent a lot of context to this.
And then I think you'll be fine if you haven't seen the X-rays, but like that's for the first time I was like, ooh, wow, those X-rays are a little bit more structural and integral to the storytelling than I thought, which is, I think, an argument for them mostly being put into the episodes. But
sure.
Yeah, I thought it's another confident episode because they really slow down. There's not a tremendous amount of action, hardly any, like other than the opening space battle, which is just a one-sided slaughter.
Yeah. No, I thought
I was surprised. I thought there would be balls to wall. I thought this would be kind of like a Game of Thrones season where like every episode is just a big battle, big battle, big battle. But again, I know it's a short season. The episodes are not tremendously long, but like I can't find the holes where they're like shortchanging the storytelling or the character beats, at least as far as a non-book reader. I'm not seeing them.
Yeah, it does feel a lot like the books. I remember
at the end of book six, things happen swiftly, and they're kind of preserving a surprise for you, right? So they can't really roll out like pieces of that. They need it kind of to happen all at once. And so I think that's why we haven't seen a lot more progress on some of these plot threads that we've had. But we get a little bit today, I was happy for that. But what really got me in this episode is the emotional scenes, the scenes between Naomi and Drummer, the scene, honestly, between Philip and his crew captain, whoever the fuck that guy is.
Tadeo, I think.
Sure. The scenes of Avasarala wondering if she's doing the right thing for Earth. Like, there's so many good scenes. And this title of Bobby Why Amos. We Fight. Yeah, we'll see. There's not so much emotion there. It's more the sweet emotion that Aerosmith, I think, was singing about, perhaps.
Yeah.
I thought all of it really came together, made an excellent episode, and I'm excited for next week to see how they wrap this up.
And I'm not super worried because I've heard from a couple people, one guy in particular, Pete Peppers, is a YouTuber that I've kind of gotten friendly with on Twitter during our Foundation coverage. And he, unlike us, just binged, as soon as he got the screeners, just binged the whole fucking thing, did like a 10-minute preview video. And I talked to him back and forth, and I'm like, I guess my best case scenario is this is like season three. It ends with like an obvious question mark, but also a thoroughly satisfying conclusion of the 3-season arc that we've been on. And he said, that's exactly right. That's exactly how this is going to feel. So like,
it has to.
I was on record. I mean, you hear me, a podcast 4 years ago, that like I said, when Expanse was hanging in the brink, if they end at season three, I won't be mad because I felt like I got a really good conclusion to the story. There's definitely more story here, but like that's a question that just literally got raised by the last episode. So like, yeah, I want to see more, but like, I also don't like, geez, what happens to Jules Pierre? What happens though? Like all the, you know, what's going on? I understood the state of the universe as it was. And then season four kicked off an entire. So I'm feeling pretty good. I'm one of the ones that's 5 episodes in. I'm not feeling like this has been I've been through plenty of hurry up. We got a final season. Your head, finish this thing. Like, I've been through that Penny Dreadful. I've been through that True Blood. I've been, like, I imagine I could think of better shows if I thought about it. this does not feel like that. This does not feel like people who have had an ultimatum and like, you know, I think this might've felt this way. Like if they canceled at season 5, but this does feel like, by all accounts, a good stopping point. So,
and if you want more, it's there, right? You can go read the books.
I'm gonna. Yeah. Unless they literally decide in the next 2 weeks that they're going to extend the Expanse or it's going to be a mini series or something picked up. Like if it's going to be years and years before podcasting about this, I'm going to go ahead and read the books for sure. Cause I want to know what the hell's going on in Laconia if it doesn't get wrapped up. So.
All right.
Should we talk about anything else or get right into the episode?
I think we should get into the episode.
But first, let's take a quick break.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga-sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
All right, we're back, and we rejoin the action as we have the last 4 weeks with the adventures of Kara the Explorer in the Pet Cemetery of Strange Dogs.
I fucking knew it.
This is chapter 5 of Kara. This everyone knew this was coming. Right?
I know. I think everybody called it like episode 2.
the only question was like, how fucking creepy is it going to be? And yeah. I gotta say, the thing is I didn't find this guy particularly creepy.
No?
He seemed to be fully Zan, her brother.
Like, well, except for the glowing blue eyes and the mottled skin and the he looked more like a risen cat to me than just like a normal kid, but.
But he's not a bad seed. Like, he's not, there's nothing menacing. Also wondering, like, how much of that, like, mottled skin was just the fact that he's recently resurrected, but he wasn't, like, angry or evil or, like, he hugged a sister back. There are some
infecting her with proto-molecule, perhaps. Who knows?
Yeah. There's some uncomfortable. What was the kid that was Praxis' daughter's friend, Mateo? Katoa. There's a little uncomfortable Katoa little moments and a little bit of like Joseph Miller when he was talking about what is the substrate, that kind of idea like Miller would talk about. I don't know how I know these things. I just know they're like in my head. Like now we've seen this manifest in like a 7-year-old boy. But I don't know. Is he a protomolecule being now?
I think he's some kind of hybrid. Yeah, I would assume.
Is this like the actual thing that Jules Pierre Miao was trying to accomplish? Is this the end goal because the strange dogs are some kind of bioengineer?
Could be.
Yeah, I don't know. It continues to be insane that like however many, what were they? They're probably in a year into the Laconia experiment that there's all this wildlife that people just don't know that much about. And these kids are. I mean, this is a funny scene. Like, I like the fact that she used the gurney bed. It's like GPS return to home. The kind of like
just
as a decoy.
Yeah.
The other thing is, again, here's where like I wish I had something beside the 320i screener copy that we have, because there's a point where Zan looks up into the woods and says something like, "I have never seen that before," and then Kara gives him a hug and he hugs her back and the camera kind of pans off in that general direction. And I was expecting to see like I remember in Bloodborne, there's this whole thing where like once you get a certain level of insight, you start seeing like these horrific beings that are like on the ceiling and are like, you know, dominating these areas that you couldn't see before because you've pierced through the veil. And I was kind of expecting to see like some kind of crazy proto-molecule vision, kind of like whenever they'd show Katoa looking at a person and he could see their glowing brain and their venous system and stuff like that. I was like, want to see, but, and they kept panning up and up and up and it was just dark evergreen. If there was something sinister in there, I couldn't make it out in my screener copy. So
yeah, me either.
That's something I can't wait when we do the live watch this Thursday. I'm going to be like eyes totally peeled to see if there's something with the 4K copy. But yeah. Mm.
Yeah, now she's just got to explain this to her parents. good luck.
Yeah, and what I guess now that this works, like, what is the Laconian high command? What's Admiral Quarte? like, these guys are pretty militarized. Having undead super soldiers, that's like every Bond villain's dream, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, I wonder if there's going to be military applications for this hybridization process. Will they get volunteers? Are they going to execute the guy that killed Zan and then bring him back with the strange dogs? I don't know. Lots of interesting questions. And like, Garrett, again, like, what, where the fuck does this go in 2 to 5 minutes more of plot?
Yeah, that's the real question. I imagine it goes to the military. They get word of it. They get wind of it. And then we kind of don't know what they're going to do with it. I can't see us getting like, I don't know, maybe you could do it in a montage, right? You could do it in a montage of them like meeting Zan and, you know, taking samples and injecting their people and seeing how that goes. You could do it, but I doubt we get that far.
All right, we'll move on to the next scene. Back in our solar system, Martian stealth ships under MCRN control assault the ring gate.
You idiots.
Where they get a brisk reception courtesy to 6 new massive protomolecule-inspired railguns affixed to the ring station, obliterating the entire fleet in a matter of seconds. Shocking. Shocking how easily they were dispatched.
I mean, yes, that is true. They were dispatched far more easily than they expected to be. But also, you idiots. Like, you said you didn't have the numbers, you said you didn't have the fleet, and you went ahead and did it with a fraction of your fleet. How does that make sense? How did you think you were going to win this?
But, well, the thing is, I think they did win against the forces that they knew about. It was the railgun, the ring-stabilized railguns that just completely took them by surprise.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
I don't know. They just put everybody else in the worst position.
Yeah, but like, oh man, this in a military engagement when you're talking about like if I was a Earthbound military leader and today, you know, and I'm planning an invasion of some country, I don't, and part of my war plans isn't, what if the Independence Day aliens come during the invasion and side with the opposition?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is like, you know, Rumsfeld, I grew up in the era of him droning on about the unknown unknowns and the known unknowns. Like, this is like the most unknown unknown that you could possibly imagine. So, yeah. Like, I think they actually achieved complete tactical surprise, completely obliterated the defenses that they had outside the gate, and were in a good shape to just kick in Medina Station's ass. They didn't know about the super protomolecule railgun. So it's like one of those things. It's like it was a flawlessly executed raid that failed because of information that they had no way of knowing. And
it's tough to tell.
Do you wait? Do you wait until Marco gets the undisputed control of the ring gate that gets his big fleet up there? It's hard to criticize the decisions because it doesn't seem like anyone has all the information and the technology to make good ones. And sitting on your hands while so many people are dying and suffering, oof, it's tough.
Yeah, it's true.
Back aboard the Pella, Renfield and Marco get and give updates on the repair status of their stricken ship, as well as the successful repulsion of the invaders from Mars. I love saying that. The invading Martians. Which ends up calling for celebration.
Yeah, and also there seems to be some unrest amongst the Velters, right? There is some rebellion going on. Iapetus is full on in rebellion. They've just abandoned the Free Navy totally at this point.
And when we were talking about this, because like this is something I kind of looked into each of these stations as far as like what their whole deal is, you know, and that is like the third largest moon of Saturn. So it's very remote, very small. Probably, I even think we talked about it being kind of like on the insignificant side. And Mark, But Marco's like, hey, this is a chink in my armor, and I can't afford to have one.
I don't like this at all. I think this is one of the weakest scenes, simply because if Marco truly believes that, then what the hell is with his decision about Ceres? Like, the biggest, the largest, the most prominent, most important population of Belters. If you think that one station could cause a cascade, how about that being Ceres Station when you abandon and betray them?
I guess the difference is, like, breaking up with the person versus being dumped. You know, like, Ceres was all part of the plan. This Iapetus stuff is not.
All part of the plan, the way that any of this stuff is all part of Marco's plan, right? It's like improvisation and moving the goalposts and all that stuff.
You know, now that I see his plan, it's actually quite brilliant. Like, his plan was to last long enough to get these railguns installed. Once he did, he has got into, like, whatever happens in the solar system, he will win the war. Long term, like, Belters will rule the world, unless the Laconians end up doing it first. But you know what I mean? Like, it's, like, not a bad play. Like, and you gotta, you know, if you look at it from a horrific calculus of you gotta break a few eggs to make an omelet, it makes a lot of sense. Because if he can just keep the inners pinned down for a matter of months till he gets enough titanium out there and gets enough of the thing, then they're safe. There's nothing that the inners can do to them.
It's a great plan, but his sentiment here of, like, one station could, you know, bring this whole thing down or start a chain reaction that does.
And I guess
I just fundamentally disagree that betraying the Belters on Ceres Station isn't that one station.
Well, and I guess the thing that that makes a lot of sense what you're saying is, like, why is Renfield the one to have to remind him of his own damn plan? Like, you know, he's bitching and moaning about Iapetus, because maybe it's a blow to his ego. I actually used a dumping terminology, but I think it might just be this is concrete evidence that there is massive unrest because of Drummer. This is like an ego driven thing. So it's like, she has to bring him back, like, look, this is our plan. Who gives a fuck? You're going to be the master of 1300 worlds. You have all the resources. You can build, you know, like, she took out one unarmed depot. You're going to have the 1300 systems to pillage and build shipyards and what, and, like, you know, it just shows what a baby he is, you know, that, like, he can't even keep the eye on the prize when his plan is working flawlessly. Mm-hmm. And she has to be the one that's kind of like, hey, you know what? This is a victory. We should celebrate it. You know, we need to get the bad taste of defeats out of our mouth. And what better way to do it than to wash it out with what was they end up drinking? The finest earth rum. You know, I forget exactly what it is. The spirits, the brandies, whatever. They're breaking out the good stuff.
Yeah, and I do love when we see them kind of partying. You see everybody celebrating and drinking, and Phillip's walking through the halls of the Pella. He's kind of like not even, you know, it doesn't faze him at all. He's, because he could have access to this rum anytime he wants, right? As Marco's son, he could bust open a crate of this stuff and just party himself all night long.
But he got his fill of that on Ceres, I think.
For sure.
Yeah, this is a direct reaction to, like, I'm going to be the guy who's serious and clocking in on time, and while everybody else is three sheets to the wind, you know?
Yeah, I just like the privilege that it shows with him strolling down the halls, not engaging with this stuff, because he, was able to do that before as Marco's son.
Yeah. So next scene, we have the joint military command of the UN and MCR in forces meeting to discuss contingency plans now that Marco has an iron grip on the ring station. Surprisingly, the admirals and generals looked over their whole tool kit, considered every option, and decided that all-out desperation attack is the only thing they can do.
Yeah.
They got this tool bag full of hammers, and all they see is nails, baby. Uh-huh. Avasarala, not so sure.
The true surprising thing here is that Bobby is not on the Rossi anymore. She's back with Avasarala advising her again or whatever.
That was shocking to me, but it also makes a lot of sense. That was a one kind of time detachment, I guess. Although, apparently, I wonder.
I mean, everybody was hoping, right, that Bobby would join the crew permanently. And I don't know that that's going to happen. We'll see. We'll see what happens next episode.
I wonder, like, how much does Avasarala need Bobby versus how much does Bobby need to be cut loose and do what she does best? The other thing I wonder is, like, how is the Rocinante going to be a central figure in this war to come? because it's just one Martian corvette. It can't like hold its own against Marco's Navy. So like what? Yeah. Like, is he going to 180 no scope his way to ring gate victory? Like I think that thing works once maybe.
Yeah. Mildly interesting. All of that. All of it. I do like the stuff after she dismisses, you know, the rest of her advisors and Bobby and her are left alone in the room. She's talking about, you know, have I gone soft? She's questioning whether the decisions she's made have been sort of ones she would have made in the past that kept Earth safe. And I think the answer is no, but I think that's for good reason. She's breaking patterns here, right? And it's there's a clear path forward for the solar system, which I like, especially at the end of this episode with the handshake. Like that is the moment that says to me the future is going to be different, and we could almost kind of leave the series there to some degree, and I would be totally happy, because fundamentally the thing that caused all the problems at the beginning is the divisions between Earth, Mars, and the belt. And if you can patch those over finally, you have some grand resolution here. And I'm happy to see that. And yeah, there's still threats out there that need to be dealt with, and we will deal with those next episode, I'm sure. But I don't know. It felt very climactic in that moment. And all of this is like her questioning her decisions and asking Bobby for her input, and then sort of dismissing Bobby's input when she gives it, because Bobby is just a tool in search of a use.
Do you think she was dismissive, or it's more kind of like, I've heard what you said and it's inflammatory and I need to think about it.
I think it's that, and it does spur her to action, I think, but it's coincidental too, right? Like Drummer showing up out of nowhere is just like an opportunity that she can use to actually fight back. And I think her version of fighting back is
Bobby was saying
throwing a punch. Her version of fighting back is putting out a hand in a handshake, right?
Yeah, but that's what Bobby's point is. Like, you know, now's not the time to sulk. Now's the time to look for the next opportunity to fuck the enemy. And Drummer coming
but
in,
but Bobby would do
massive...
that with a punch to the face. Bobby would do that with a railgun round. Right. Avasarala sees, yes, okay, the sentiment is correct, but I need to use this. I need to do this in my 100%. Way. Yeah.
And I think the point you're talking about, like the odds against, you know, like the fact that she's like, you know, are the odds in our favor for this attack? And the Admiral's like, well, no, but, and she dismisses him. I that's the thing though. Like if it's, you never know in war, right? Like, two episodes ago, James Holden defeated an enemy fleet that had a 3-1 numerical 5-1 missile advantage. You just never fucking know. And these admirals know we got better ships. We got better training. We got probably more cohesive discipline. If we hit him with a big enough punch and now we know the rail guns are there, we can like, you know, because they're all they can see is like the other thing is like, what, we're just going to give up. We're just going to negotiate terms. We're going to do that's the thing. It's like, you know, if no other options exist, why not the all out attack? Why not like whatever forces we got left? Because who knows? And the advantage shifts to the enemy every day. So, like, I'm not super against what the admirals are saying here. It's just more of, like, I'm glad Avasarala has got the wisdom to, you know, to maximize the opportunities that she has and has the allies that she's gathered over the last few seasons and make changes. Because season one, Avasarala could not successfully prosecute this war.
No.
She would. She'd lose.
No. Yeah, she needs Naomi specifically in this moment, which I think is interesting, you know, with how... not mistrustful of her she was at the end of season 4, but like, you know, there were question marks, right? Or was it season 5?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
You know, where they're all hanging out, she's like, oh, can I trust Naomi? Because she's a belter, right?
Right.
Yeah, there's just a lot of good stuff in these scenes.
The UNN wants to reinforce the Rocinante with new protomolecule-derived carbon silicate armor plating. Shades of the blade of armor. You always heard them going on and on about Deep Space Nine.
Sure.
Which Peaches has mixed feelings about. Then, as predicted by some of our listeners in the feedback episode, Dr. Okoye lends a critical assist to Naomi's research into the Ringgate disappearances.
What do you think about what Claire is saying here about her father and being all the things that are happening here, you know, kind of making it seem as if he was right.
Man, because it's something we just talked about in the feedback episode, right? The fact that can Jules Pierre be correct when he's also the fault of all this happening?
Right.
Like, what if instead of clandestine, they said, look, we've got this new thing. We're going to give a sample to the best scientists in the belt and the Mars and the Earth, and we're going to work at this like a joint Manhattan project. Does any of this happen? You know, and then you go back to like, I feel like people are going to accuse us of pre-watching because I felt like a goddamn genius. Like all of the stuff that was like laid out by like Drummer and like, you know, the whole like, you know, this has been 100 years of oppression. You guys could have stopped and changed it and we'd have a totally different conversation. And why is now going to be different? It's tough because it's like that old saying. It's like, you know, if things were different, then they'd be different,
sure.
You know, but they're not. So they are. But I can understand why she personally has misgivings because this is probably her darkest fear. Oh God, what if my dad was right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what if my dad, Space Hitler, Space Mengele, what if he was right to do all the crazy fucking research and that ended up, it'd almost be like if you were like the niece or the daughter of one of those Nazi scientists and it turns out some of that crazy fucking research actually solved COVID, you know, as a direct result.
Sure.
Like, does that make that shit right? Does that mean that
you don't have to be wrong to be an amoral asshole is what I would say. You know, methods are sometimes just as important as the means. So, yeah, I don't know. I still think Jules Pierre is an asshole and probably did a lot of terrible things that didn't need to happen.
And didn't need to. And certainly, like I said, the thing is, like, what makes him a unique asshole is he unilaterally took it upon himself to do all these things with shadow governments from all the major factions. That's what makes it especially egregious. Like, this wasn't something that the whole human race, through some kind of lever of democracy, decided jointly. This is just something that, like, the rich and powerful decided that they had to do because...
And decided they wanted to test it on people without their knowledge. And shit like that is the horrifying stuff. I'm all for researching anything we find out there, right? Like...
Yeah,
let's research it all. Let's understand it. Let's make it useful for us, but let's do it in a way that doesn't get a ton of people hurt or killed in the process.
Yep. There's also the specter of Amos going AWOL, I think is like, that's the first thing I thought when I heard that he's off the ship and hasn't told when he's, I'm like, Jesus, Amos might just be gone. You know,
I was wondering. Really, yeah. After that scene with Holden where, yeah, he, I don't know. He felt betrayed by Holden, for sure.
There was some speculation, maybe informed speculation, from some listeners last episode about Dr. Okoye giving the assist to Naomi. We said that made a lot of sense, but we were like, well, is she actually through the ring gate? Turns out she is. She's in a Europa lab, and she's able to confirm and firm up a lot of these predictions and analysis that she's done. And it turns out that, yeah, like there's a certain threshold of energy to mass ratio that a ship can trigger that brings on a disappearance or makes the disappearances more likely to some pattern here.
I like this better, I think, than it happened in the book. Because correct me if I'm wrong.
I said partially informed speculation. Did Dr. Okoye actually lend this assist in the book?
I don't think so. I don't remember that happening. Okay. I remember it was more Naomi figured this out herself, but it makes a little bit more sense that it would take like a research scientist to understand the patterns that we're seeing here. But
especially this research scientist that had this experience
exactly. With
these red gate energy beings, entities that Holden's talking about. Yeah. And it's also, I thought it was nice that it's kind of like the theme of nostalgia of this season. Like, hey, we brought back Pax, or Prax, we brought back Dr. Okoye. Like, all the periphery characters from years before, they're still alive and on the board. We're going to bring them in for a little COVID era webcam, you know, tight being shot so they can get a line or two in. I liked it. So I'm glad that it felt like more of like our whole team from all six seasons is coming together, like the super friends or the Avengers, and assembling.
Yeah, I half expected when we heard that Amos wasn't, you know, coming out or back on the ship or whatever immediately, that he was like off sending a tight beam to Eric or something on Luna station, Luna base.
It would be cool to see. I got to say, it would be very cool to see Eric somehow. And like one, get a tight beam from here. What do you, and then the final of this, that they also speculate that, like, are these entities trying to get out?
Mm-hmm.
I guess if I'm predicting a season three type resolution, that there is going to be an after credit scene of like one of the ring gates collapsing and some red energy pouring out and fucking something up. I don't know. Because that's what it feels like. That's like the proto molecule was the antagonist, and then it turned out it's just a fancy screwdriver.
Mm-hmm.
It would make sense for a real antagonist, an extra human antagonist, to show up to kind of kick off the hostilities for the next trilogy.
Sure.
Because otherwise, it's just going to be splinter factions of Earthbelt and the Mars again, and it feels like that's not quite the expansion that I'm used to for these big trilogy jumps. But anyway. Mm-hmm. At the end of the scene, Drummer and her fleet arrive on Sirius Station, towing massive amounts of food and supplies, and are greeted by heroes, or as heroes by most, but not all.
Yeah, the UNN. Oh, God.
I love Avasarala come in, like, get off the line, asshole! I need to talk to this lady!
I'm so glad she does that. I was tearing my hair out when there was this blockade of their supplies.
Because you can see Drummer, like the thermometer bulb just rising and rising. He's like, you know what? I'm going to fucking turn this shit around. Fight my way through.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
we got three torpedoes left, right?
Yeah. Yeah. This guy, you know, demanding the quarantine and boredom and do all this and that and just following orders. And it's
while the Belters are actively starving. Yeah.
The only thing would have been better if like Avasarala literally, instead of cutting him off, she just literally flew in from the camera and like shoved him out and been, or Bobby throws him in and she's little manning him in the background while Avasarala is talking to him. But yeah, that guy needed to stand the fuck down.
Yep.
And you can see, that Avasarala starts off trying to finesse her, and Drummer is like a street cat that does not want to be pet. You know, like, she's not buying, like, oh, Fred Johnson spoke well of you. Well, he spoke well of you too, but like, we didn't agree on a lot. You know, like, she's just like every compliment and pet that she's trying to be given, she's not having it. And says, matter of fact, like, I came to help the Belt, not you. And pointing out quite correctly, like we spent a lot of time talking about in the feedback episode, this is a result of a century of Belter oppression. If not Marco, someone would have done it eventually.
And directly, and years of Avasarala being who she is, right? Like,
she made it worse. She made things worse, yeah.
As she says later, like, Drummer probably knows her as the person who hangs Belters on the wall in 1G and tortures them. So, like, yeah, she's... And, you know, Drummer can't know if she's changed. I think we, having followed her for six seasons now, do feel like she has changed. But boy, her reputation precedes her.
What a character evolution for Drummer in particular. Like, every season has like beat and molded her into the shape that she needs to be the leader I think she's going to be in this season. Like, you know, she's the ultimate evolution of like the Fred and Dawes's, that the Fred Johnsons and Anderson Dawes's of the world. She's the synthesis of the and the Clay Ashfords of the world. She's the synthesis of all that stuff. And it's really exciting to see. And she's also holding this because she sees it happening to herself and she doesn't want it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to be the prime minister of the fucking Belt. I don't even want to be the supreme dictator. I don't want to, I just want to help other Belt and I don't want, but eventually when you move up the hierarchy of helping enough people, you're going to get into politics no matter what, you know, even if it's the politics of a small organization.
Sure.
But it probably feels bad.
Really feel for her in later scenes, in the scene with her and Naomi, where she's just stuck, man. Like, she's already given so much to this cause of helping other Belters that to turn back now would make all of that pointless, make it all worth nothing. And, you know, she doesn't I don't know. It's tough. We'll talk about it more when we get there, but that's a really excellent scene. I feel for her.
Back on board the Pella, Philip is doing his best to ignore the rum and brandy and the bourbon flowing freely aboard the Pella to clock in on time for his latest repair shift. Finds out his partner, Tadeo, is missing. Turns out he's in the brig for breaking radio silence, trying to contact his brother on Ceres, who he's been worried sick about.
Yeah. Not too much to talk about here that I haven't already talked about. The payoff is coming in the next scene of this.
Yeah. I thought it's interesting because, like, this practice of, like, breaking out the good stuff to celebrate big victories is an ancient naval tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for going back to, you know, since they were sailing, like, you know, rum, sodomy, and the lash, you know, 16th, 17th, 18th century sailing traditions. Like, you know, you've got, you essentially keep the sailors drunk as much as you can. Because number one, it sterilizes the water that they're drinking. Number two, it makes the severe deprivation and shitty nature of living on a wooden boat in the void of this ocean bearable. And yeah. I just even without thinking about using the expression three sheets to the wind, which is describe the condition of a ship where all the sailors are drunk. They've lost control. The sails are blowing. They're not tied down properly. And I got it as a sailing kind of fanatic myself. I got a kick out of that. Drummer consults a physician on Ceres who tells him that Yosip's new baby arm is fucked, is going to have to be replaced. She also receives an unwelcome phone call from one Naomi Nagata.
Strong Scary Movie 2 Chris Elliott vibes in this scene. I'm not liking it.
The strong hand.
Yeah. My germs and
I was thinking Deadpool. You know, his little regrow. It makes a lot of sense, right? Like, if you're going to regrow an arm from, like, stem cells or whatever, it's probably going to look like a fetal little thing. But I don't know. It's interesting because, like, you know, we know Drummer regrew her spine, and she's talking like it was less painful for her. So something, you know, because the gel was too weak or whatever, it's just not taken, and it's growing back in a way that's going to be useless and painful. So they're going to have to root it out. And I guess it's one of those things where it's like, you try it once, and if it doesn't take, then you got to do the prosthetic. So
apparently,
you're going to have Robo Yosip.
Yeah, I don't know that we see them again.
Doesn't seem like it. It felt like goodbye, and we'll get to that. So Avasarala gets the good news about Prax's new protomolecule derived superfood. Then Holden briefs her on the sudden risk of the Ringgate travel, which leads her to making a big ask of him and the crew of the Rocinante.
What do you think about these meds that she's taken? Are you still?
It does seem like it's space meth.
Yeah, she's just
like it's just go juice. Like I thought it was a health issue she was having brought on by distress, and it does seem
it's
like
possible still. She could be lying to everyone about what it is, but yeah,
I will say that, like, if there's an episode 6 Avasarala just hanging, like, you know, Alex Kumal style from her grav boots in UNN1 because her heart's exploded from too much meth because her all of her vital conditions are in the red and she's pushing it harder. Actually, that's a pretty expansive way, because it'll bring into question all the things Drummer worried about. Like, well, sure, maybe I can trust you, but what about the next guy's coming right now? And I don't know. I feel. So if you haven't seen the X-ray episode, there's an X-ray episode about Avasarala where she's consulting with the doctor, talking about starting a new medication. And it was in the context of her looking at one of her iPads and seeing that her, like, multiple body conditions were in the red zone, blood pressure and heart rate and different, like, cortisone levels and stuff. And we were thinking that, like, she's suffering from a serious medical condition. It does seem like, because that was in the context of her wanting to take a nap and being interrupted and, you know, realizing that she can't, she doesn't have time. And I think she's just never sleeping and taking space meth.
Yeah,
stay up.
Certainly sleep deprived. Whether there's more to it, who knows? We'll see.
But it does seem like that the one happy ending is Earth is probably going to be okay. It's still fucked, super fucked, and not going to be a pleasant place to live. But people aren't going to starve by the billions.
And not as many people will starve.
And it's going to have applications for the Belters too, because Ganymede was super fucked as well.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
I absolutely love when Holden comes in and starts telling her things. So this is directly after Bobby tells Avasarala that Holden disarmed the torpedo that could have killed Marco, right? She tells her that?
Wait, who? No. Amos tells Bobby that.
Amos tells Bobby that, yes.
I don't think Avasarala finds out this episode.
Okay. I could have sworn she found out this episode, which makes this scene doubly crazy. But okay, even if it doesn't, like, he comes in here and he's like, I've got something more important than the war, and we need to warn Marco that the things he's doing could cause problems for him. And she's just loses her freaking mind. You are the most naive person I've
James,
ever met.
James, you are truly one of a kind. Like, as soon as he says, what do you think we should do? We should tell Marco. Oh, James, just like, you know, it's like she smelt a fart or something. She's just waving like, get out of my car.
Yeah.
It's really funny.
I'm with her. I think Holden is correct ultimately, as he always is, right, in his assessment that like everybody should know everything for the greater good of everyone. But the timing, man, the timing is not right, and she shows him why. So
I would love if Avasarala starts doing, do you remember that old spoof movie Airplane? Where there's the guy that's like, I picked the wrong day to quit smoking cigarettes. She's like, I picked the wrong day to quit sniffing space glue. I picked the wrong day to quit injecting space meth. Like every new fucking thing that happens, she's like getting thrown out the laser bong. She's doing whatever she can to keep going, man.
Yeah. Holden. Oh my God. It kills me.
There's also a nice send off with Monica here. Cause she's like, this is so fucking grimly funny in 21st century America that, she has this thing that's resonating with people, this lazy earther segment that we saw filmed, but also the guy who's the lazy earther guy is getting death threats because he's being used for, he's the inner's pet, special pet number two. Like there's no unmitigated good sentiment that you can air today that won't get a sizable fraction of the population angry with you.
Sure.
And this feels like exactly the same kind of thing where it's like, this guy came out and just like, can't we all get along? Fuck you, like that's you should die. We're gonna space. That's what happens.
Yeah.
So yeah, she and then Avasarala coming to grips with who she was and how keeping Earth safe has put it in the greatest, not just Earth, but the entire human race in its greatest jeopardy ever. Mm-hmm. Like what a crushing realization that must be for someone like Avasarala. And she's lost so much. Her son. Oh, yeah. Blajun. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a net positive, but it's she's gone through a lot of pain and learned these, paid a premium of these prices, and the irony of her situation is not lost on her. Great character. Turns out Jim, Amos on Siri is having a bad case of the shore leave. Bobby hosts an intervention of sorts. Amos drag her down into the shore leave, or will she help him rise above?
Some seriously bad bedhead going on there, Amos. Jesus.
The glitter beard.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see this in 4K. Because I didn't see the lipstick. I saw the neck scratches. I saw the beard glitter. And him just kind of staggering into the bar and seeing Bobby there. And she's like, you just drinking and fucking? He's like, till they run out of one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
Yeah. And I like how Bobby is able to sort of talk him down from, making I don't even know if it's a rash decision here. It maybe is warranted in the situation. But then, she tells him like, look, the only reason we fight ultimately is because we're fighting alongside the people we love. Which is exactly what Drummer is going to hear from Naomi later, right? That brings her around. So. I think there's a very good theme of why we fight in this episode. I understand why they called it that.
Yeah, this is something, if you've ever like read military memoirs or seen movies like, Saving Private Ryan, Band of Brothers, Black Hawk Down, multi-generations of soldiers, you might sign up and enlist for various causes or whatever. But when you're, like she says, in the shit, it's just about the people beside you watching each other's back, hoping to survive the next day.
Yeah.
And Amos realizing what a complete shit he would feel like if he reads like some blotter item while he's fucking and drinking his life away that the Rocinante's been killed in action.
Right.
And like, what if I was a, like, that's the thing that like crystallizes his mind. Like, shit, you're right. I need to get back to Rocinante. But first,
yeah, the brothel.
one last round into brothels, and he invites Bobby, and Bobby,
yeah,
does not turn him down flat.
And she's like, you know, do you want me to go to partake of the brothel or partake of you? And he's like, yeah, whatever. Which I feel like is Amos to a T, right? Like it rings true of like all the illest stuff that happened with him and
yeah.
That UN, or not even UN, it was just some mercenary corporation.
I don't know. I think Bobby's always been a little flirty, horny, you know, like whether it's wanting to wage a war on Alex's gut or seeing what Amos's little man is capable of. I wonder if they're going to like they'll hint to whether this actually happened or not, because it's Schrodinger's bang session. Like the look on Bobby's face as they cut is like perfect, kind of like, well, no, but then again, you know, I hope they do. I hope they do. It's all I've been shipping this shit since season 2. So
especially if they're not going to crew up together, I think it's even there's even less incentive for them to not.
I think they do crew up. I actually think that's one of the resolutions is that the you know, this is the final season. Like, what the fuck is she going to hold Avisral's clipboard for another episode? Or is she going to get back and be a goddamn gunnery sergeant?
Yeah.
I don't know.
They certainly haven't set her up to take over Avasarala's position. She's still looking for a fight, mostly.
Yeah, for sure. We're about ready. We're getting into the end game of the episode. So let's take one final break and then get back to it.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, we're back with an emotional scene. Michio informs Drummer that neither she nor Yosef will be rejoining her in the war effort, choosing to remain behind on Ceres under the oppressive boot of the Inners. Macho Peru, and probably your final scene, breaks Drummer's heart. This is what you book readers have been waiting for, I can only assume. This is what the big moment the Macho Peru is going to do. Just break Drummer's heart into all four chambers. There's a piece that they can give to Yosef and Naomi, and Macho keeps one for herself.
No, of course not. They aren't the same character in the book and the show. Yeah, I like this scene. It's a sad scene, but it's the best way for this to work out, right? Like, absolutely, you can't have a dude with a baby arm, you know, not pulling his weight.
With a cyber stump.
Especially when it's not like, oh, he can't pull his weight, right? Because I think Drummer would be willing to forgive him working a little slowly. It's the same thing with like Holden and Naomi, where it's not that Holden doesn't think Naomi can live with him killing Philip. It's that he can't live with it. Joseph can't live with being dead weight on this ship, or even his own, even if he's not complete dead weight, his own perception that he's doing less than he should be. And then Michio can't leave him behind. Like there's a finality to this when you realize that Drummer's entire family is gone now, which I didn't realize. When I watched this the first time,
yes,
and I hadn't seen the scene with Naomi and her yet. And then I realized, oh shit, yeah, I guess her entire family is gone at this point. It really makes this scene hit a lot harder on the second watch.
I continue to be so glad that I did a complete series rewatch. Because I started ticking off, like, you know, because you first meet Drummer in season five, and she's just sleeping in this big puppy pile of belters.
Yeah.
And there's like six people in one bed, and these are the people she's going to tick off that have died. And like every one of them, like, oh, right, they left Yaxanon that left because of the, and then, you know, this guy, yeah, got spaced by Marco, and then here's, she's alone. The whole, the Polyam Belter fam, is done for. And it's a blow, and
it doesn't really show on Drummer, right? Like that's the thing. Drummer is so composed at all
times.
Numb.
And she's just numb at this point.
She is. Yeah. And that really shows in the Naomi scene too.
Like Ashford, like she's had so many lost. Fred, even like all of her friends, lovers and mentors have been gone or taken from, except for Naomi. Mm-hmm. Which they've had, you know, clearly a troubled, you know, like a complicated past. And she's the one, she's the ghost that shows up at this kind of low point. But I thought it was a great line when she's like on her way out. She's like, you know, I never loved you because you were fighters. This is something she's saying to Macho in particular.
Mm-hmm.
I loved you because you were builders and I wanted to build something with you. And instead, everything's been destroyed. And goddamn, Carrie Gee.
Mm-hmm.
Renfield once again soothes Marco like the baby he is, burping him and putting a pacifier in his mouth before laying him down in his crib for a nap.
I'll recategorize this scene for our listeners. Rosenfeld. I almost couldn't remember her name because you keep calling her Renfield.
I'm so fucked. You put a gun in my head. I couldn't tell you which of the three things I've been calling her.
Rosenfeld. Properly assesses that it is not just the turning of the war that has Marco down, but it's also the relationship he's having with his son, and uses Philip's performance, his speech in the mess to bolster Marco's confidence in both himself and his son. That's what I saw happening here.
Where did he get that fire? And Marco is kind of impressed, which I'm still on the theory that there's going to be a sudden and inevitable betrayal of Philip, of Marco by Philip. Because boy, they keep building those blocks. They keep laying that fucking track. And this is going to be the thing where, like, simultaneously as Philip is like, you know what? Fuck my father, for doing this to me, doing this to the belt, doing this, that, like, Marco is going to be fully trusted in his son. So he's going to be at that position where he can do it. It feels right. And it also will retroactively make James Holden look like a fucking genius for sparing him.
Sure. Mildly interesting.
Yeah. And these things dovetail together just so you can see the divergence of the track. Philip receives word from Ceres that Tadeo's brother's been slain, which causes a crisis of faith in both of them. I found this pretty emotionally effective just because I think the kid playing Philip is terrific.
Dude, and so is the dude playing Tadeo. Both of these guys are nailing these roles.
Because you can see Philip comes in with like a Marco, like he's trying to do that thing where he gave the message to his friend's family that he killed. You know, he's trying to be the military officer and he's standing stiffly at attention and he's just mad, like, hey, I regret to inform you your brother died. And he's saying, and then like what was unexpected, and this makes so much sense, like all the scenes we've seen with this guy, like why is he so obsessed with this? Because it's the dock worker and the dock's got Tadeo. In Tadeo instantly realizes that this is ultimately his fault in a very real way. In a complete a rejection of all of Marco's bullshit. Or Marco never takes personal responsibility. It's always for a greater good. It's always where, like, today it's like, and you know, honestly, that doc would have been bombed regardless. But Tadeo wouldn't have been responsible for it if he had said no. And like, you can see the look on, like, you know, because Philip's like, no, it's the inners. No, it's my fault. I'm the one that planted charges. I believed them when they said it was going to be just inners. And it's just, and just falling apart. And like, I felt like Philip is hugging himself as much as he's hugging Tadeo because he's just realizing, like, the scales are just falling off of his eyes. Like, this isn't just like, well, I've left the Belters or the inners a problem to deal with. He slaughtered Belters. Primarily Belters suffered over the inners. It's a really impressive scene from him.
It is, absolutely. I felt it. And it is surprising to me that they got there with a character that we met, what, two episodes ago, and they brought this around in that amount of time. It speaks to, you know, how quickly things are moving in this season, even if I'm not sure I realize it in the moment, but scenes like this really reinforce it to me. Like, boy, we are moving through this stuff really fast, and it doesn't feel like anything is getting shortchanged. Like, this scene proves it.
And there's such good storytellers because, again, like, it's just like Tadeo just being obsessed with the news and, like, you know, like a word about, like, just so many layers to that storytelling. Yeah. And then they get to this point where the guy just, like, I just think of other lesser shows we've seen where they would have done this in one episode. And, like, just having a foresight to put little building blocks an episode or two in advance so it hits for not just the viewer, but. The best storytelling is when the characters and the viewers are synchronized emotionally and have a crushing realization at the exact same time. And I feel like The Expanse does that really well of aligning the viewer with the emotion of the scene and the inevitability of what's happening. So you feel the same kind of despair and catharsis or whatever you're supposed to. Like, they're just really good at it, especially so economically.
That's the thing, too, is all these scenes are pulling double duty, right? It's not just they're establishing this new character and setting up the stakes for when we find out that he killed his brother, but that's also having direct effects on Philip and larger effects on Philip. Honestly, like, he's the main character in these scenes, but these scenes are like every little layer is adding both to both stories for both of these guys. And I really appreciate just how streamlined the storytelling is in this final season.
It reminded me of what we were talking about before the Christmas break when we did our Jurassic Park review, that, like, how And this goes back to also our recent Jaws retrospective, where like Steven Spielberg is just a master at every scene doing two or three things. Like he's introducing a character, but he's also telling you something fundamental about dinosaur DNA or the nature of the paleo. Like everything is doing at least three different things and setting up a different additional scenes. And that's what you got to do if you're adapting a huge, dense Michael Crichton novel or a giant Dan and Ty, you know, sci-fi magnum opus in six. You've got to do that. And like, they took a plot line, which is just Philip got a demotion. He's on the outs with his dad and did three other things with it that are now like, it's how you fit 90 minutes of storytelling in 45 minutes each week. Mm-hmm. And it's, it's so good. It's, this show is so criminally underappreciated
for sure.
By its own community. It feels like, I feel like so many people have just like gotten butthurt about the end and like they're not nearly as excited. There's this massive pall cast over the season because of it, and it's just a damn shame. Drummer is able to bypass a UNN security checkpoint, getting to back to the docks, leading her to be called the Inner's favorite pet. Then as she's stewing over that, Naomi drops by her ship, the Tynan, unannounced. This is an apex scene.
It is
apex emotional predator of a scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a shitty way for Naomi to come back to Drummer. Not ideal. Not the way I would have liked to see them get back together. But it has to be done for the greater good, right? And it's almost surprising that it works. Like, if all the pieces don't come together just the way they do, and that's the other thing I love about the storytelling here, is it's very intricate. It's not just that it's, you know, every scene's pulling double duty, but the pieces that are moving all need to click together in a certain way. And of course, they're able to do that because they're writing the story and they can make any piece click wherever they want. But it feels right when it happens. Like Naomi coming back, being forced to come back for the greater good, to talk to her friend who she's kind of been on the outs with at the moment where her family is just gone. And now she has to give her a reason to continue and a reason to almost betray herself in a weird way. It's crazy good, man. I love this scene.
And the thing is like, that's what we're talking about, the loaded and the multidimensional storytelling. Is it hit me really hard when Drummer made the realization at the same time I did that Naomi wasn't, because I thought they're just like, you know, it's been a while since, you know, they had that short episode. They need to pay that off. But the fact that Naomi was there, not because she cared about Drummer, not because she wanted to make amends, not because she wanted to apologize, but because she needed to ask for her to embrace Avasarala.
She's doing a favor for James Holden in this moment. And you got to remember, like, there's a line in here where Drummer says, some of us have lost more than others. And if you look around Naomi, the devastation that you see around Drummer just isn't there. It's not there. Like,
oh, no.
She hasn't truly lost Philip. Like, yeah, she
lost Alex.
Alex
lost
like
her son to a
one.
Cause, but not lost him. Yeah.
But not lost him in the way that she lost Serge, right? Like,
not finally. Yeah.
Drummer has lost multiple things in the ways that Naomi has not. And I feel like her coming back and asking her to give more is just such a slap in the face. But.
And what's great is like, Drummer doesn't do the like suck it up and be like, but she. What I think makes it work, because you said like, because like when they turn the corner on that and Naomi's like hat in hand handing her, I'm like, is this, but like what works is they allow Drummer to comment on how unfair and shitty it is. Mm-hmm. Like when she just like, you know, fuck you. It's like very much like, you know, the where and also the fact that Drummer is insistent, but also like completely open and honest, like when Drummer's like, there's got to be another way. And Naomi's like, well, then show me the way and I'll help you. We'll join your side if you've got the solution. And Drummer pauses, realizes there is no solution. There is no place in the universe that she wants to be in.
Well, so it's like, except
what's the lesser of the two evil situation
at her family's side. And Naomi's right. Fighting like Bobby says, fighting for the people you love in those moments. Right. And Naomi says it here. And it turns out that the only person that Drummer loves at this point is Naomi. She's got to fight alongside Naomi, right? If she doesn't do this, Naomi could be next. It's like she's lost everything, and yet she still has this one thing that she can rally behind, and she knows Naomi's right. But man, it's another huge ask of her to continue down this road after she's lost so much. And she does it because she gets it. She understands. But man, that's a hard choice to make.
It's great because it also works just like visually and thematically, because like the door opens and Naomi's there. She's uninvited. She's invading Drummer's personal space. You can tell Drummer like kind of retreats into a reserve of politeness and like, oh, come on. And then when she invited him to ship, I'm like, oh, my God, what is her crew going to think? Because like a big sticking point for the last two seasons are, do you love us as much as you love Naomi Nagata?
Uh-huh.
And then I realized that she's walking like these are all strangers.
Yeah,
the Drummer's family is already gone. There's no damage that can be done. And then like it keeps escalating, like, you know, Drummer tells her to leave the ship and Naomi can't because she's got to do her mission. And she clears the bridge. It's like, oh, fuck.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's going to be it just the way they do. Like I noticed this last season, too, where, you know, there's things where like Naomi or a Drummer is talking to Oksana through an airlock. There's a physical barrier because they're not being honest and not talking about the things. And then when they finally, you know, leveled the airlock opens and Drummer steps into it. They do so many things with like this ship being her inner sanctum and like in her personal space or emotional space, and Naomi, you know, penetrating it deeper and deeper. It's starting to sound sexy, but you know, like she's trespassing because she needs to, she has to, she's causing her friend pain. She's like, yeah, it's great. It's really great. And like, I really felt for Drummer, like resisting the, you know, Naomi's embrace, but also giving into it because that's inevitable too. Man, what a great scene. Yeah, I didn't expect fantastic. This many emotional scenes in the penultimate episode of a war right? science fiction series. Avastral and Drummer have a real Roosevelt and Stalin meet at Yalta moment in the center of Ceres Station, where the old adversaries try to find common ground and common cause in the war against a free navy. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of or a big student of history, but one thing I know is after World War II, the U.S. and USSR were fast friends, never betrayals, never mistrust. That joining together to beat a common evil foe just was forged an alliance that lasted down to this day.
Sure. That sounds right to me. How about her call sign, Burn Angel?
What was it?
Burnt Angel, I think, is what they call her. I don't have subtitles, so not sure, but
oh, for Avasarala or
yeah.
I thought she was Archangel.
Archangel? It sounded like Burnt Angel to me. And maybe they switched it up. Maybe she's, you know, changed her feelings on the Belters and she's changed her call sign with it. I don't know what it means, but I thought it was interesting. She's looking great throughout this whole episode and always. When has Avasarala not looked great? But
yeah,
her style has really changed over the last. I only really noticed it this season, but she's wearing a lot fewer saris and she's wearing a lot more like suits or like darker overcoats, palette. darker tones. Yeah. It looks fantastic on her. I love this like leather trench coat, asymmetrical, like, I don't know, almost torn looking dress, like a cave person kind of dress.
I thought it was interesting that like Drummer's the one that's always talking about wearing a collar, but like Avasarala is actually wearing a collar and throughout this episode.
Sure.
I thought there was an interesting symbolism of like who's really in control here. I thought it was it because, like, you know, it's an interesting moment because Avasarala correctly deduced that Drummer was not going to come see her on UNN1.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to have to go and put herself at personal. I mean, we saw the Marines land and secure this area and they were wearing battle suits and they had a battalion of soldiers behind them. Right.
Yeah.
And now Avasarala is going in here with like three or four security guards. It's a great scene because like all the stuff I made a joke about the Soviet Union and the United States because like this is the exact same thing we were talking about last. Like, okay, so we're friends now, But once Marco's defeated and the ring gate secure and everyone's going about their business and everything goes back to normal, then how long is going to be till it's fuck Belters? And even if the rest of Madame Avasarala's rule of Earth, she's eventually going to die. And like, are the people, but like, you know, how long is it going to take to get back to fuck Belters?
Yeah. Is poor man's Paul Giamatti going to step in there and fuck things up? What's going to happen?
Yeah. Or Major, whoever the hell this guy is.
I don't know his name.
And there's it makes all logical sense. You know, you hate Marco. I hate Marco. I don't have enough ships. You don't have enough ships. You know, the quicker we end this thing, the less death and destruction on both sides. Like, yes, we have been responsible for centuries of oppression, but there's a billion people dead on my planet that have paid for that price. Like, you know, and it's interesting because the show seems to be like, as I mentioned in the it's my political theory that like anytime there's a generational dispute, the stronger party is going to be the one that has to take a punch. And I feel like Avasarala has embodied that. Like, as soon as Earth got attacked, what did Earth want to do? Mm-hmm. Nothing more than to lash out and just destroy the Belters, destroy their stations, nuke series, all that stuff. But Avasarala is like, well, what is that going to get us? And like, yeah, she is trying to absorb the punches. She's trying to absorb the jabs, the needling, the attacks, and just keep it like, well, this is what kind of in a much more abrupt version that Naomi was doing, but like, this is what we have to do. There's no other solution. It's a thing that makes the most sense. And you might not like, all I can do is give you my word and hope that this does forge a lasting peace and trust and alliance. And I don't know.
Change has to start somewhere. You know, unless you think like Marco does, where some grandiose display, some wild swing is just going to totally obliterate the other party. You have to start somewhere with change. Yep. And that's what I think is so significant about this, right? It's two of Praxis, you know, or Claire, I forget who says it, two of those good people coming together to do the right thing. And it is the tiniest of things here. This is not going to fix hundreds of years of oppression. This is not going to fix it overnight. This is not going to fix it maybe in the next 100 years. But if you don't start here, you're not going to change anything. You've got to start somewhere. And that's why I like this scene.
Going to guarantee more of the same, which you know, has led to the death of billions. So,
and I love that this is Avasarala fighting back, right? When Bobby says, "I just want to get out there and I want to stop, you know, shoegazing, and I want to fight back," or soul gazing, whatever she says, and I want to fight back. This is Avasarala doing it. It's just Avasarala doing it in the way that actually can work, the way that. Not just fights back, you know, militarily and maybe beats the enemy into submission, but changes the status quo. This has the potential to change everything between the belt and the inners.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's like, there's this, you know, they quoted A Song of Ice and Fire, the unbent, unbowed, unbroken. They also came perilously close to J.R.R. Tolkien's, you know, Legolas and Gimli. Did you ever think that you'd be fighting alongside an elf? What about a friend? You know, like there. But that's the thing, is like, that's not Avasarala and Drummer, but and you know, the they had their kind of Legolas and Gimli moment as well. Mm-hmm. And it seems like they kind of pan out. This is the last scene of the episode. They kind of pan out to show the greater Ciri station, and I was looking, like, picking out in the crowd UNN officers and MCRN officers and Belter civilians, and everyone seems to kind of be murmuring their assent, like, you know, between the lucky Earther, between Marco showing his ass, between Earth and Mars standing there and helping them, even though it is against their best interest, like, all the things that Avasarala has resisted doing in the last season and a half has now built to where she has this moment. Because that's the thing. Imagine if Earth had nuked fucking Ceres. Like, Drummer would be like, get fucked, get perma fucked, get mega fucked. You know, there would be no, this opportunity wouldn't even exist. Like, there's so many doors Office Rala could have walked through in the last two seasons that she didn't, to allow her to credibly be like, I am no longer the person that tortures Belters on gravity hooks. I feel like a real asshole for that. And that's not enough. Like, you know, it's like, again, like, in a probably fair world, Office Rala should be punished for that kind of shit. Maybe she has, but the death of her husband and the loss of like a tenth of Earth's population under her watch. But you know, it's an imperfect world, and at some point people have to trust and people have to rise above the provocations and the atrocities, and I think the appropriate side's doing it. Earth.
Yeah, Earth and this
Mars isn't are the ones coming to the table.
This is not like, you know, the solution to all the problems, and it's not going to change things overnight. And I'm sure there are still Belters who live on Ceres Station who probably still think, fuck Drummer, fuck Sarala.
The station administrator.
What a traitor. She's making, you know, all those people are still exist, even though Drummer came in and essentially like is the de facto leader of Ceres right now, right? Like, most of the Belters probably appreciate what she did, bringing the supplies in and just handing them over to her or to the station.
Because you can tell
it's
going to
be
like,
other people.
Like, reasonable. I would put the station administrator of Ceres. They have established themselves in the exact same thing that Drummer said. Like, I don't serve Marco. I serve the people of the belt.
Yeah.
And they catch Drummer in 4K on their data pad being the lapdog at the inners, you know? So like, you can tell probably, you know, like there's probably a big war in the hearts and minds of Belters. Like, what do we think about Drummer? You know, she came and saved us, but she's also helping the, and it's
even on Sirius Station is the crazy thing to me, right? Like, that will happen. You know, you'll have the hero come in and save your ass, save your life, and you'll still hate them. Like, it's not a guaranteed win for everyone on Ceres, but
yeah. Well, nobody wants to be saved. You know, they want sometimes they need it, but then nobody, almost no one wants it.
Sure.
Anyway, it's a great episode. I still am like, even with all the assurances I've heard from people that have seen it, it's still hard to believe they're gonna stick this landing in another hour of television. But if I'm gonna bet on anybody, it's gonna be this crew, because they've done just a terrific job of adapting these novels. It might be my new favorite adaptation, because like Lord of the Rings has been my previous standard bearer, maybe got the Godfather films, but like this has been a true adaptation. Like, the books and the show differ markedly, but yet feel so consistently in terms of tone and their characters and all that, that like, you know, you could like, if you're done with season three, you could pick up book four and start reading. And like, these characters, even though they've had different lives and different adventures, they still feel the same. Or contrasting, you could read the books up to season up to book three and then jump in on the series and book. And it's so seamless, even though so many things have happened differently. It's just such a great adaptation of one material, of one medium to another. It might be my new favorite.
And that's why I'm not overly sad about it ending, if it does in fact end after season six permanently. Because I know we have three more books, and I can just jump right into those, you know. I don't feel like
you won't miss a beat.
Fundamentally change anything by jumping into the books right after this.
And of course, you know, that's the thing. It's like, I flatter myself to think I got 40, 45 more years ahead of me. I wouldn't be surprised if we get an Expanse at some point, you know, and I'll be just as excited as a 70-year-old as I would be as a 45-year-old to rejoin my old friends, James Holden, Naomi Nagata, Amos Burton.
Yeah, think of all those Star Trek fans. Because
Alex still kicking
70s.
Around the books too, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, that's true. That's true. He's still alive in the books.
It's going to be wild, because as soon as this series is done, I'm going to read book six. And it's going to be interesting to see Alex still alive. That'll be the first kind of like real, like, oh my God, cognitive dissonance that the show has created in the adaptation. Yeah. And that's something that was forced on them. That's not something they made to call themselves.
True.
So that's what we think about this penultimate episode. We want to hear what you think. Expanse at baldmove.com is where you can send that. We will have a feedback episode out early next week to get you all set up for the penultimate, or the finale episode. And don't forget, you're cordially invited to watch the show live with us as it premieres
on twitch.tv/baldmove at 7 p.m. Eastern. We're going to gather at, again, twitch.tv/baldmove and live watch the episode start to finish.
Yeah, it's Thursday night.
If you already have the Amazon Prime subscription, all you need is a free Twitch account. It takes about 30 seconds to link those two together, and bam, you can watch it along with us and the rest of the Bald Meat community. We'd be delighted to have you. But either way, the podcast for this episode will be out immediately it's at the exact same time. You can enjoy that, and then we'll have a final feedback episode and wrap up, and then that'll be the end of the Expanse for now. We'll see if the Expanse expands once more. Mm-hmm. But I'm so nervous, excited for this next episode. I had to put my son in a straitjacket. Like we wrestled. He was like, had the last, he's like, Chromecast the next one. I'm like, I can't, I've got a job, I don't care. And I had to physically, I had to put him in one of those Martian prison cells that have the isolation thing in it, because that's how much he wanted to see it. And I'm right there with him. It's a couple more days for all of us. We'll see you around. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.